purpose is really simple. We've been sanctioning Iraq for 9 years to slow down their weapons of mass destruction program and also to try and remove Saddam Hussein from power. This hasn't worked, but right, there's a lot of parts saying he's still been able, it's actually been more effective for him to develop his weapons of mass destruction. And he's certainly not out of power. In fact, sanctions have provided a rallying position within to strengthen his regime within Iraq and also to quell popular opposition. Right, one of the reasons is because the sanctions suppress the middle class and lower middle class so much, there's no chance for a popular revolt in Iraq. Okay. So our argument is that what you wanted the sanctions to do, they haven't worked whatsoever. In fact, they kind of backfired. The byproducts of the sanctions are that millions of Iraqis have died since 1990 as a result, because there's no access to any sort of food or medicine. You know, there's no jobs, big famine sweeping through the country. And so we say that the impact cards are amazing. Like 150 Iraqi children die every day. That's 12 by the end of the debate round, I think we figured out. We have cards talking about it. All the uses of weapons of mass destruction in the history of the world will never kill as many people as sanctions in Iraq do. So it's a nice little 2-AR story for you to set up, right? Even if I lose all the dissads and all the case turns bunk, I lift the sanctions and save Iraq, I outweigh whatever your dissad is, because no impact would be as big as the death of all these Iraqi kids. And that's basically the gist of what the Clays claims. It's just big deaths in Iraq. Now, we also have we turn out all of the answers, you know, because people are going to say things like it would just, if you lift sanctions, it'll just speed his weapons of mass destruction program. We turned out turns to that. There's answers to terrorism, right? Because that's what a lot of people say. We got to keep the sanctions in place to make sure he doesn't have the ability to sponsor terrorism. We turned out answers to the oil position. There's going to be a lot of people saying when you lift sanctions on Iraq, it allows them to start producing a bunch more oil, which can do some things like drop the world markets prices or divert our oil attention from other regions we might be trying to develop. We got answers to that. I think it would turn out Clinton answers. I think there's answers to just about everything. And there's also a nice little stack of negative case turns and some solvency stuff. And we also turn out answers to counter plans. So this is really an easy case to understand. I mean, there's nothing tricky going on here whatsoever. But we might have questions. So if you all have any, feel free to ask Jan and I. That's the affirmative, though.
Well, maybe the assignments we did were the Clinton political thing, the political dissads, and we actually turned out 2 dissads. The first one is the Clinton dissad. It's just straight up a political capital story. Your plan is unpopular, at least with certain segments of either the Jewish lobby or the Cuban lobby or other different segments in Congress. Maybe Jesse Helms, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And the only story is that Clinton has to burn political capital to get plan passed. The cards are, the interlinked cards are from the fall 99 issue of Foreign Affairs, are really good, talking about how Clinton needs every ounce of political capital he has in order to create some sort of lasting relationship with China, because our relations are really screwed right now because of the embassy bombing in Kosovo and because of the Cox report and the sphere of espionage and everything. And then the impact are just U.S.-China relations. The impact card in the shell is, you know, a multiplicity of scenarios that U.S.-China relations are critical to solve for. The other position we put out is a Helms position, and the Helms position we put out is a very bare-bones structure. If you're going to run it, you'll need more research on it. But the Helms story is, Helms is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. All of foreign relations legislation has to go through his committee, and he's a very powerful person, and he's also a very obstinate person, and he's willing to not let things out of committee, which he has the power to do. Like the Chemical Weapons Convention that we ratified a couple of years ago, he held up in committee until the last minute and had to negotiate and, you know, concede a whole bunch of things to him and give him a bunch of things he wanted in order to get the CWT released from the committee. So the story on the Helms position is the CTBT, which is the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And our argument is that Helms is going to continue holding it up in treaty in committee, and the only way that it'll get out is if you make concessions and everything. And right now, Helms is sponsoring a piece of legislation that's a compromise legislation on sanctions, which is that he's saying, yeah, I'll agree to the lifting of medical and agricultural exports and not have those covered under sanctions. But he's a very strong believer in sanctions, and he's got an article in Foreign Affairs that outlines every reason why he thinks sanctions are just the most wonderful thing. And it's like Cuba, the sanctions legislation about Cuba is the Helms-Burton Act. You know, he's responsible for all this stuff. So our argument would be that he will see this as a bad faith effort, that he's willing to negotiate on the sanctions that plan passes. It's more than what he's willing to do. He gets pissed off whenever it lets CCPT out of committee. And the cards right now for the internal link that we put out in the packet aren't the best, because people just started pushing for the release of the CTBT like a couple of, like about a week and a half before we wrote the position. And so there wasn't enough time for the cards talking about compromise and things to be talked about yet. But those are things that will probably come out within the next couple of weeks, assuming that the senators who are pushing for the release continue pushing for it.
Those are two were put out in the first place. Right?
Yes. Yes.
I have a question. This may seem like a little risky thing to say, but like, how do you measure like political capital? Like, say your argument is that Clinton just doesn't have enough political capital to do both. You know, like all the arguments we've hit on it, the sort of like have been like, well, how do you measure political capital? I mean, why can't we just do this now? You know, Wilmington, this is going to happen until September.
Not going to be an exact science, and you're never going to be able to actually say, well, you would have 93% of political capital. But there's a couple of things. The first is maybe refer to the father, a really good part we turned out talking about how presidents have limited amounts of political capital to use, right? Also, it's a lot going to be in the way you spin your story, right? Right. Think about what political capital is, right? It's the favors that Clinton can call in. It's the act kissing he's done in the past to build up some allies on certain issues. But think about how contentious the plan is going to be, right? I mean, he's going to have to call in every single chip he has to ramrod removal of all sanctions against one of these rogue countries through Congress. If you spin the story like that, it's easy to explain to a judge why, even if it's not, you know, a measurable amount of capital, at the end of the day, he's going to be pretty damn weak, right? And he's certainly not going to be able to get something as contentious. And like, he could probably get something pushed through the next day that wasn't contentious at all, and there was no opposition to. But we're talking about like a potentially a one China policy, a policy of appeasing China. But there's a lot of backlash against Clinton in Congress. Also, interestingly enough, the proponents of appeasing Taiwan over China are the same people who don't like sanctions, right? Like Helms and Shelley and people like this, right? You want to keep the sanctions in place are also the ones he's going to have to go head-to-head to on the China issue as well, which is a really good story, right? Because, you know, it's not like one day he's going to slap them in the face and, you know, and tap the plan, then the next day try and get them to actually deal with him on this China issue, right? So it's not that, so when they say that, I mean, your best bet is just trying your uniqueness today that he's pushing for it now. So any cap he does have, he's using on China. And, you know, read your win card, spin that story, drop a couple cards in the currency to talk about he's only got a little finite amount of political capital to use. And at least you're going to be able to prove that it's quantitatively perceivable, this concept of political capital, without ever actually having to say that, you know, it's 80%, 85% or something like that.
And you strengthen your story by having lots of different reasons why you'll have to burn political capital. So like the different lobby groups, like the Middle East case or Jewish lobby groups, he'll have to burn political capital there. There's one party, you can use the Helm stuff as internal link helpers for the political capital story too, because there's one card saying Helms is threatening to hold up all sanctions legislation in committee if he doesn't like it, which means that he'll have to really pull in a lot of favors with Helms and burn a shitload of political capital with Helms, and that story becomes really easy to tell just because Helms just does shit like that all the time. You know, like, I will hold stuff up unless you grant me X number of favors.
This isn't like we were normally used to debating either, right, where the plan is, yeah, the plan's contentious or the plan's divisive. This is really, like, one of the most hot-button issues among Congress right now is what to do about sanctions. I mean, it's very, very politically unpopular to talk about engaging these rogue regimes with the public and also with large amounts of Congress. So it's not just like you're saying, well, you pass the Title VII policy and, you know, that's not a lot of people like civil rights legislation. I mean, those cards are decent, but these cards are good. You know, talking about the, just the hatred some people have for the concept of lifting sanctions and actually, you know, being complicit or engaging with these evil, evil regimes. So.
And the fact the resolution mandates that people have to lift all or nearly all sanctions guarantees you've got a pretty decent link story going on. It's a big, big policy. It's not like people can, you know, like they did last year, say, we're just itty-bitty, nobody will notice us. No, everybody's a big plan on this topic. So.
You're not going to sneak lifting sanctions on Iraq past the Jewish lobby, or you're not going to sneak lifting sanctions on Cuba past the Cuban American lobby, if that's your general story. Like, they're not going to forget at any time.
Or fail to know.
No, they're pretty damn aware, you know. Any other questions on Clinton? No. I advise you, even if you hate Clinton, y'all, I mean, you really should read this file, and you really should keep researching it, only because you're going to hear Clinton every single round this year. You know, like you do every year, but this year the Knicks are actually doing pretty good, I think. So you got, there's a high potential to lose on Clinton. So I would really make sure you understand it for the sole reason that you can answer it.
And we also turned out a lot of different link and internal link stories that aren't how the dispatch run. You can use returns and you can use to write different stories when you get home. So there's a lot of the theory cards for the internal link on popularity, political capital, winners win, answers to winners win, and a standard internal link story. So
there's lots of answers in there, too.
Yeah.
Jason and I also work together on both ways. Second way, we worked on plan-inclusive counterplans, and they are too numerous to list. There's a bunch of them that are just two or three cards. Many of the plan-inclusive counterplans fall on the idea that we have some products that are important, and one of the side ramifications of lifting trade sanctions is that all of a sudden Cuba gets a taste of our pesticides, our tobacco, our infant formula, et cetera. All the bad stuff that we tend to like to dump on other countries. And so these counterplans lift all sanctions except for X and just use whatever cards they specific products are bad for people to say that net beneficial is better than the plan. So there's a bunch of them that fall into that category. And you might want to take a look at there's theory blocks on picks good and bad that are not part of the just analytical, but on the picks bad stuff you might want to take a look at and read over kind of a term argument there too, because I'm not certain that a lot of these single product picks are gonna really be all that useful, as if you look at the current sanction law, it doesn't really list off all the single products you can't support. So you can say there's no sanction on tobacco specifically now, or there's no sanction on the formula. Some of the other counterplans that are not simply bad products, or that I think are fully developed and deserve a little more discussion. One of them that is a product, pesticides, but pesticides are unlike all the other products because they're both bad potentially for agriculture, but they're also precursors for biological weapons. So there is kind of a reason why now we sort of look when someone wants to export some pesticides. Affirmative answers on this are not also saying places like Iraq really need the pesticides in order to get agriculture up and going again, because famine is one of the major impacts of the case. We have a counterplan that talks about the Jarama nuclear plant that is possibly going to get built potentially in Cuba. If affirmative is overturned the Helms-Burton Act, they also overturned Section 111 of it, which is the sanctions that specifically are designed to stop this nuclear plant from coming online. So the counterplan gets rid of all the sanctions except for Section 111 of the Helms-Burton Act, and says that these sanctions are effective in stopping the nuclear power plant. You know, it's a bad nuclear power plant, it's on the fault line, it has inadequate safety, lots of cars saying it'll blow up, and you know, spread radioactivity to 80 million people and these sorts of things, so probably better to not have that come online. We have a little bit more development of encryption. You can now export encryption to your own firms, your own subsidiaries, anywhere on the globe, except for in the terrorist list states, which include all five of the topic states. So if we de-sanction them, that probably means taking them off the terrorism list, since that's where some of the sanctions come from. And one of those sanctions is that you can't export your encryption there. So getting hands-on encryption and getting it into the hands of rogue states would allow for nuclear terrorism to happen much easier, is the argument
because it's easier to hide your financial dealings from law enforcement agencies, and it becomes much harder to fight against terrorism and information technology. And then the last one would be that there's a lot of evidence on the financial sanctions counterplan. These cards say that all the bad stuff that's associated with sanctions is associated with trade sanctions, where we stop trading with another country and have an embargo. But the kinds of sanctions where we impose financial burdens, like you can't get access to capital markets, you can't get IMF or World Bank money, and sanctions that are much more targeted so they really hurt the elites in the country as opposed to the masses, are more effective when they're used alone and can get said countries to change their policy in whatever way we wanted them to change it. So we ought to get rid of the trade sanctions but keep the financial ones. Hopefully that's less than what the affirmative plan does, just of it. And then a couple of the more minor counterplans where we don't have a lot of cards, but I really want to draw some attention to them for the rounds here. There's one called the normalization counterplan, which says that we ought to drop the embargo. It's a similar card to the one that came out in the Cuba packet that we've been debating forever, but it's a different card saying normalization and dropping embargo is more than just doing constructive engagement, which involves the potential for sanctioning people. Doesn't involve doing everything as far as the embargo goes. And so, you know, if embargoes are bad, why not go all the way and normalize instead of going half the way and constructively engaging? And then there's a couple of things that aren't written as counterplans, but
I think the evidence is a pretty sweet piece of hospitality evidence too. The card draws a distinction between what constitutes normalization and what constitutes constructive engagement. And ironically enough, it seems to imply that an immediate lifting of economic sanctions constitutes normalization and not economic and not constructive engagement. So it describes a plan that says that that's not a top flash. And so ultimately the counterplan functions. If we put it out this way, because ultimately, even if you lose the counterplan, you've probably got a pretty substantial hospitality argument against the case. And the fact that you can counterplan in that fashion demonstrates the distinction that the evidence draws between topical and non-topical ground. And it defines it contextually even more so. So I haven't seen any evidence which did that, so I think it's pretty important for that reason.
Cool. And we also came across a couple of Iran-specific cards that are sitting towards the end on, like, under additional counterplan ideas. One of them says that the sanctions that are specifically targeted against Iranian missile proliferation, because they're so targeted, are very effective, and so they ought to stay. So you can counterplan to get rid of everything but those. And then the second one are there are some cards that say that, you know, we ought to get rid of the sanctions with Iran, but it ought to be in a delayed fashion. We need to discuss the particulars of the arrangement with them beforehand, get an agreement on it, and lift sanctions after that diplomatic discussion takes place. And we didn't fully research these arguments. We just found, like, the stumbled onto the card saying that they'd be good ideas. But if you look through the negative stuff on the Iran packet, it looked to me like you've got the cards to put these things together into a complete argument if you combine the two packets to do so. So make sure to draw your attention to that. Any questions about... Yeah.
I have a question about the Drago plan. I think most cases during the year will list all economic sanctions, including U.S. technologies and military sanctions to begin with. Section 111, exactly what is that prohibit from being traded with Cuba and dealing with the Drago plan?
Well, there's a copy of it in here.
Yeah, that's the thing. We did put one of the things you might want to...
Page 41.5.
In terms of... the way plan visit counterplans work this year is whether or not it's fair for the negative to be able to sanction specific items as opposed to targeting laws. And what I mean by that is that one of the pages in there is a long list of all the potential products that are banned by our sanctions right now. And there's a piece of evidence from the United Nations that talks about the United Nations and how sanctions work with them, and that talks about the fact that there are almost a million products, or it says there were millions of products in the card that could potentially be sanctioned, which might seem like an unfair burden for the government to have to deal with. And so there's a list there. Anyway, we included a couple of lists of the types of things this could cover.
Cool. And the section, if you read it on page 41.5, is fairly vague. It says that we're offset and discourage any assistance from any country in building this by making sure if they're receiving aid, it's reduced by whatever amount they spend on.
So it doesn't, it's not a section which goes through and identifies specific nuclear technologies on a specific list.
And not all nuclear technologies dual use either.
Right. That was a lot of fun. What kind of things?
Sidebar, the power plants sometimes aren't kind of weird.
What case would be possible could you lift all sanctions immediately and still be constructive behavior?
I don't know. I think that's an interesting question because it seems to be the way the evidence read, it indicates that that action would be an action of normalization. And the distinction it draws that constructive engagement seems to be a process where we have a quid pro quo sort of thing going on. We don't just lift everything because that would get rid of all of our...
normalization.
Basically, it's just that the constructive engagement, you've got to have some bargaining chips. And if you get rid of all the bargaining chips, you're not doing constructive engagement. In fact, it says that what would happen would be in the process of constructive engagement, we would modify embargoes, for example, and modify our sanctions, but we wouldn't get rid of all of them. Sort of,
I think it's not according to consistent with the literature on constructive engagement.
This is the conclusion we came to last night as well.
But what do you do?
Skipping the negative.
Yeah, or at least interesting. Another way to think about it is that we constructively engage China, probably, but we probably just have normalized relations with, say, Great Britain. Right, constructive engagement wouldn't describe how we deal with our allies. Any other questions about PICS? Okay, we also wrote an Israel position.
I think this strategy will be at least useful for, I think it will be useful throughout the year. And basically we started with the idea that Israel is a pretty critical country in the Middle East and three of the top countries are there. Subsequently, almost anything you do in the region is bound to affect them or at least cause some sort of reaction within the country. And given how big of an ally they are with us, that would probably be fertile ground for negative positions. The first argument that we wrote was a consultation counterplan. Basically, you do the plan, but you consult with Israel about the plan itself. This probably won't be relevant, just so you all understand this, but obviously it won't be relevant, for example, against Cuba. Probably won't have very much to do with North Korea, but at any rate, maybe you can find some evidence. You can do some research if they want to make consultant. I don't know. At any rate, if they do the plan in Syria, Iran, or Iraq, this makes a lot of sense. And the counterplan would just have them talk about and negotiate about what we were going to do in the region.
You can't guarantee that the counterplan does exactly the same thing as the affirmative plan. It just suggested in diplomacy and whatever we agree on with Israel is what happened.
Right. So it may be that you don't suck up the case, but the advantages to, I guess, doing the counterplan are pretty massive. The first disadvantage that goes along with this is the U.S.-Israel relations consultation disadvantage. Most of that evidence talks about how Israel hates it when we do things sort of arbitrarily in the region. And this is especially true right now for a variety of reasons. The first kind of is the fact that Barack, newly elected, but there's a new premier, or there's a new prime minister, in Israel, and he's trying to jumpstart the peace process. So that sort of arbitrary action in the Middle East is bound to either make him look bad or cause pretty violent reaction from Israel. The consultation link evidence gives good reasons why the counterplan would avoid all of the disadvantage and the case would ultimately become the case would cause it. The impacts to that, I believe, are just a peace process impact. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm sure that was just a peace process impact that you want to support the peace process. It's a good thing. It prevents war. People don't fight each other. That's good.
I should also say on that consultation counterplan, and it's also useful for the DISAT, there's a bunch of cards that explain, and they are referencing NATO, but they're definitional in nature, what consultation is and isn't. So people can't say, global means means consultation, or we will consult and then do X, because they say that consultation means that long before any policy is publicly announced, there's a lot of low-level discussion, negotiation, coming to a joint position. You can't just say we're going to do X and consult, because the process of consulting means we have no idea what we're going to do until after we have consulted. So there's no way in which you can say the affirmative plan is a consultation plan if they lay out the specific mandates. that's pretty useful for making sure you got it at that link and got counterplan competition and such.
The second position, all three of these ads, for what it's worth, will work with counterplan. The second disadvantage is what we call a relations or encirclement position. It basically just says that Israel won't have, like, if they don't like when we do nice things with Iraq or Iran, they consider those people their enemies. And the basic argument is just that when you do something that's pro-Arab, they freak out. And that's a bad thing because of the current tension in the Middle East. The impact story, I think, is pretty good. It indicates that in a situation in which our relations with Israel went down significantly, that it would result in Israel looking weak and Syria would respond by making a land grab in the Golan. Israel would retaliate by nuking Syria, and that would cause like a big, fat, nasty war. It'd be real ugly. The good thing about the impact story, I think, is that all the cards assume a Syrian land grab, and they also all make the same claim, which is that the U.S. wouldn't intervene to protect Israel in this situation, so they'd be on their own. And the nuclear war escalation card is pretty good. So, the third position, I think, may be the weakest position in the packet, but I think it's pretty important we put it in because I think it's a position that will be viable throughout the year, and that's Barack credibility. At least you've got the beginnings of the position here. I would recommend doing more research on it. I think this will be a position that's very viable as the season progresses. The main argument is just that because Barack's trying to jumpstart the peace process, he needs to look pretty strong, and he needs to have a lot of credibility with people in the Middle East, and the plan by doing such an arbitrary action at this point in the peace process makes him look fairly bad and prevents his ability to negotiate the peace process out. We put in some good answers that suggest that his credibility is already tanked or that he won't really be able to solve the problem on his own anyway. So you all have some answers to the position, even if it's not at this point functionally as good as it could be. The other three things we put in were sets of cards that we thought people would want to have as the year progressed. There's a big stack of cards to talk about the peace process as good and bad, and you can use that as those on the affirmative. Just to, you know, to argue that we wouldn't want to support the peace process in the first place and those sorts of things. There's a big stack of cards that are time frame arguments that like either the peace process would succeed or it won't succeed. You can use take out the impact stories. And then there's also a fairly substantial number of cards on Israel's nuclear disclosure policy. Most people in the Middle East kind of pretty much assume that Israel has nuclear weapons. They've dropped hints about it, but they've never come out and formally disclosed that they do. And there's a lot of debate about how the rest of the people in the Middle East would react if they did that. So we gave you all a fairly, at least some effing cards, or should you hear this argument, you're prepared to take it.
What argument does the literature make as to why pro-Arab U.S. sanctions will make Israel look weak?
The card just says that they don't like those sorts of policies because they want to be considered the U.S.'s number one ally, and it makes them nervous. The evidence is actually, I believe, it's been a few days since I looked at it, but as I remember, it talked about how the Israeli media plays up those issues and causes people in Israel to pay close attention to U.S. policies, which seem to favor Arabs, and that they react, because they almost have an opinion poll or something that supports them. Reaction to those policies. And such a radical shift in our current policy towards one of those three countries which they consider enemies would certainly be perceived. And they'd probably freak out about it.
Well, right. I understand that, but the current link is, I thought I understood that for the Syrian land grab, it would make Israel look weak, not be so upset Israel.
Well, the evidence says that if there was a significant decrease in U.S.-Israel relations, then that would result in the following situations.
Okay.
So, I mean, it does say relations.
That argument doesn't come off the Barack position so much as it comes off the U.S.-Israel relations or U.S. relations argument.
Why wouldn't the U.S. intervene in Syria and
I believe that the cards talk about the fact that it would happen too quickly, and they wouldn't try and intervene in a situation where this thing could happen. Also, the cause of relations had to increase.
So this is a nuclear strike, and it's just probably immediate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty quick time frame.
We don't have a security treaty with Israel, or forces us to come to their defense.
Mm-hmm.
The first wave, my group put out a theory of water affirmative. It also can involve the rot, because the issue is that the turkey has the water and how much they'll let nations downstream get. And those nations most specifically are Syria and Iraq. They share rivers. The story is they should build a pipeline, the most viable technology we find. If you want to do desal, fine, go on your desal cards. If you want to do some sort of water-river agreement, like if there's some regional regime about to establish a water thing for the rivers that exist, fine. We thought the peace pipeline stuff had the best solvency. It was the most viable technology for the area. You could run a Kurd scenario, you could run an agriculture scenario, environment food thing. And also, I think, turn to work on Israel in terms of supporting the peace process, and use peace processes with impact. That if water's all cool, then we can have peace. That if water's a prerequisite toward the peace process. We also did a Islamist position. You should be aware, just like the Christian right likes to mess with politics in America, there is an Islamist fundamentalist politics in the Middle East, and they like to mess with it too. In Iran, they were successful. It's the Islamic fundamentalists in Iran, in Iraq, and wherever, are just like the Christian right from the U.S., right? They want you to get into politics. They want you to take over government. They want to make it government a religious matter. And the Islamists are the ones that you would refer to in the Middle East to do that. So any penetration of the West upsets the Islamists. The Islamists organize to try and win elections in the Middle East or Islamic countries and win control of the government and make them religious state. And the thing is, because it's based on religion and not party lines, it's likely that the Taliban in Afghanistan might cross a border into Iran to support Islamist parties. So they'll cross borders to get into, you know, elections and deal with politics, because it's not really, well, are you Afghan or are you Iranian? It's, are you Shiite? You know, what's your view? What's your view of Islam? And that's how they coalesce and do their thing. And so there's some potential conflict there. If you're, you know, in constructive engagement, westernizes in any way the target country, then the Islamists fire up. There's also a critique that says picking on Islam is bad, the West doesn't get it. Slightly different than post-colonialism, which has the colonial mindset. This is saying that the West just doesn't get Islam, and it's a unique thing. The second group, we did the shunning critique. I think the shunning critique is probably useful to offer a counter deontological decision rule. If affirmative says, right thing to do is to stop people from starving, and you can say, no, wrong, right thing to do is to treat evil people like they're evil. Of course, you have to go into a whole Christian support network for that, which probably uniquely gets the Islam critique, because it is Christian ethics, the science of what's right in the world, and that's why we have a military to back that up. We are God's army. So you thought the Islamists were messed up. Jesus is mighty militant wing right here. But that's the thing. That's why I think that it's good, because it just provides that the ontological be rule, no, sanctions are morals. Starving kids are moral, you know, hey, if we get those starving kids, that's not deontologically right to give people food. What's deontologically right is to shun them if they misbehave. We shouldn't reward them. Shunning is appropriate, and that's what we should do. And then also some peace stuff. I think there's like 12 or 13 shells, probably stuff that's good for you to run camp and get started. We try to tie the violations to the standards as much as possible, providing explanations as to, given the definition why it's a violation, not why in the abstract we come up with some ideas of why things possibly cannot be topical. And then we try to do the extension definition in terms of they're framed a little bit. You shouldn't have to read every definition. Each one should be tagged and should give some indication of what it's about. We try to separate them out, those that are useful for the affirmative and those that are useful for the negative, on each word that we could.
The author
makes those claims, but we did not go into an extensive defense of deontology, because I presume that the affirmative will already present that framework. We're just saying, here's a counter deontology. There's a couple of cards on existentialism that might provide you a D rule in terms of existence and choice and freedom and what it means. And those are just sort of gooey critique cards you could probably put with anything, but you could extend it in that way. And if you really wanted to get into it, you could probably even look into the defense of natural law and universal morality. If you wanted to get into the position, you'd have to do all those things. But at this point, the main author, B-E-V-E-R-S-L-U-I-S, Beavers Lewis, Reversalist, or Evawaluwi, is the ontological moralist in the C-sub point.
Okay. Questions not related to
anything? Take Mark's
research.
Oh,
sorry.
Both.
Yeah, do.
Case is pretty straight up. Embargo for the last 45 years or so against North Korea after basically losing the Korean War in the 50s. And about the last 10 years, things have gotten really terrible for North Korea. They've been experiencing American standard for rural poverty, but they got a huge cut in funding for the Soviet Union when it fell apart in the Civil War. Dried up basically about the early 90s. So with embargo from the West and no aid from the East, in the early 19th century, North Korea experienced big flooding problems, big agriculture problems, and famine starts to set in, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And the last 3 or 4 years, I guess more than 10% of the population has died, and one generation of children, like the next generation of youth, is all brain damage. So the plan is to lift sanctions to all areas and all standards, provide emergency food aid, emergency agricultural training, and pesticides, that kind of stuff, and to begin constructive engagement of the most liberal variety, not really just for tactics, but for religious engagement. The authors mainly and they don't get much of the quid pro quo at all. They're just like engagement. You know, it's much more important than engagement. The advantages include decreased catastrophe and suffering and encouragement of getting to the family who might continue for at least another year or 4 years. And then also to the big state advantages are to slow the appetite for missile sales by North Korea, including about 150 long-range missiles that are going to be bombed to be stabilized in the future. So decreased financial incentive for that, as well as decreased incentive to develop nuclear weapons programs to get attention and get leverage. And the main piece of the case is that the country is, in addition to famine, et cetera, is probably going to implode because it's just drag and collapse of their economy and morale. So that's bad because that would probably result in North Korean lash out and war. So the case really is to try to prevent the implosion, try to help them get back. Yeah, definitely. Well, the last thing I said is that status quo is not going to reunify with the nuclear virus alone. So, yeah, you can go in a different direction from that, which would be toward free communication. And most of the cards say it's not going to happen soon. Engagement will get you there eventually, at least a decade or 2 years after that. But yeah, the strong affirmative story is that status quo is maybe a couple of years before. We didn't really, I think we put out a couple of cards, not really a prediction on that, but definitely there's a lot of tension between Japan and Korea, and then also also a huge amount of tension between Japan and China, too. So anything that can be sort of in position also enhances Chinese a little bit, because they're still communist partners to their neighbors. So I think the story's pretty strong on that. There aren't that many cards in there that would be good. Yeah.
One of the advantages was reducing their desire to get involved. How does giving them more money and increasing, it seems like that would be increasing their ability to buy more money?
That's the response, I guess, that we're just dupes and they'll use the cash to develop more weapons. I think the affirmative. First of all, they don't really care that much if they do use it to develop nuclear weapons, big deal. And then also, the argument is the reason that they're doing something incredibly unpopular in the world stage, which is a shunable offense of developing nuclear weapons and having those in Japan. The reason they're doing it is because they're in such a huge bind. They're basically doing it to get attention. I mean, it happened coincidentally at the same time they got cut off in the Soviet Union, early 90s. So basically, they're starting to starve, and they realize that. So it's a method to get prestige, since they've lost their big brother, and then also a method to get some attention and cash. So if they don't need the attention cash anymore because they're fully engaged in them, to the point of the organization, then the logic follows that they won't need to do prestige for their weapons programs or the missile sales. They'll probably still do it to some extent, just like we do massive missile sales and massive nuclear development.
What are the assurances that they will learn to the people that are supposed to
be? Not a lot. I mean, there are quite a few cards saying that that's a type and that they definitely will be their people. And yeah, probably a lot of them go to the military. And again, they've gotten given into soldiers until they were soldiers. I guess it would just be a case of behavior probably. You're right, some of it won't get to the right people, some of it will just be stockpiled by the machine. But the cards are pretty good saying that it will be surveyed.
You could probably argue that it would be politically stupid for them not to feed their people at some point, as with the threat and the stability of the regime itself, that they probably have some self-preservation reasons to make sure people can eat.
But there's cards from NGOs saying that you're just getting to the right places. This brings up the primary negative argument against the North Korea case, which I think is pretty cool, which is a big part of it, to be honest. It's a counterplan which argues that NGOs, non-governmental organizations, should provide the aid instead of the U.S., and probably South Korea would be the natural actor to help the U.S., because South Korea is right there on the border. And would that benefit for having NGOs do it instead? And another plan point for the counterplan is that they would do it without any labels on the boxes, without any seals indicating South Korea or United States of America, without any labels along those lines. And the net benefits are that North Korea is very, very resistant of aid from South Korea or from the U.S., and that it creates a lot of hostility. And there's some pretty awesome cards that say that it creates so much friction because of fear of impotence that it would leave that issue alone can lead to revolution. So that's a pretty good net benefit. Because when you're dealing with international relations that are extremely tenuous like that, between two arch enemies like the U.S. and North Korea, which apparently we were very close to war with them in 1994, you need to have a third party to act as a go-between to accomplish some kind of coup d'etat.
Also, shunning the net benefit to that NGO counterplan, right? Because it wouldn't be our government being complicit with people, right? So people got a lot of mileage out of that argument on the Southeast Asia topic, so I'll go hear it again.
So that's North Korea, and then the pro-lit stuff, which is coming out now, is pretty broad area of issues to bolster your pro-lit needs when you find yourself around or the issues come up. The two main areas that can be useful for you, two kind of guiding points. One of them is they're both arguments against the non-proliferation mindset. So affirmative means, and this could work for against the negative also, but primarily the affirmative case is the claim stopping pro-lit as an advantage. Stopping proliferation in Iran or Iraq or North Korea or whatever, which I think would be probably a pretty common advantage. You'll hear probably every other from the brand.
So the negative argument is the non-proliferation mindset or regime is flawed for two primary reasons. One of them is the racism that exists. Europeans control the known nuclear weapons, which are legitimate, and southern nations shouldn't be able to develop their nuclear weapons, which is like a racist or just anti-Islamic or anti-third world classist issue. Really good card on that. And it also acts as a case term because it's the U.S.'s prolif, vertical prolif, that actually causes most or all third world prolif, makes them feel insecure, makes them do modeling based on that as a security method for a variety of things. So there's that argument which operates at a critique level and a case term. And then another, the other primary argument against the non-proliferation regime is an alternative called managed proliferation, which recognizes first that proliferation is inevitable, and second that non-proliferation efforts, like the NPT efforts to try to get countries to stop developing nuclear weapons, fail. And in addition to failing, they actually cause proliferation for the critique reasons that were explained, the us-them dichotomy. It's okay for us to have weapons, but not for them. It actually infuriates them and makes them want to proliferate even more. And so the situation is creating an inevitable accidental nuclear war risk because a lot of countries have unsafeguarded nuclear bombs, and we're stuck in this flawed non-proliferation mindset that's not working because proliferation is inevitable, it's coming. Instead, we should shift to a different mindset, which is managing the proliferation gap, which is to give a lot of safeguards to these countries. For example, permissive action links, which are locks on bombs, enhanced command control of communication, enhanced satellite information, verification about, like for example, India and Pakistan, we could assist verification for Pakistani groups to go to India and Indian groups to go to Pakistan and these stations to watch the bombs and make sure they're not tested or whatever. So there's a lot of different aspects that other, just like transparency, exchanging information about each other's bombs and other confidence building measures. So that's what managed proliferation is. And it's pretty good. The trade-off cards are quite good, saying that if you focus on trying to stop proliferation, that absolutely trades off with managed proliferation perspective. So the net benefits are just stop war. And then eventually the goal is disarm. And the cards say that the way to get to disarm is for us to do managed proliferation now, respectful of these new countries that are inevitably proliferating. And while you're doing that, the U.S. and Europe and Russia should slash their own nuclear arsenals to get them down to a level where it's equivalent with the new country.
Unilaterally?
Well, it would be quadlaterally.
All of the same times. Like
U.S., France, Britain, and Russia, and hopefully China, too. Mm-hmm.
Did you come about with any evidence that says that
yeah, there's definitely some strong evidence on that, but I think this, the more pragmatic one is to do the managed proliferation while continuing to disarm. And then there's another aspect besides disarm, it's called devaluing. There are a bunch of different steps within the disarmament literature, but one of the main steps is to simply dismantle the nuclear weapons that you have. I mean, slash a bunch of them, but the remaining bunch, dismantle them, and ship them off into different, like, you know, 20 miles apart from each other, so you can't be assembled quickly, and then have monitors there from your opposing country, who pretty much just live there, and then as soon as they notice any activity, they come in tunnel and say, okay, put yourself on a higher depth line. But that's pretty persuasive evidence that that works, too. So you wouldn't get rid of them. Probably transition. Yeah.
What about Japanese voters? You come across Japan complications, Japan plans, Japan career mix, what kind of stuff?
Just Japanese rearm based on if North Korea proliferates, Japan would rearm. Taiwan, South Korea proliferate, equals Japanese rearm, that kind of stuff. But I didn't look for one of the cards on Japanese complications. I suppose you could use those cards that they were talking about too. Work it together.
What about Japanese nationals?
No, I don't see it. I mean, I'm familiar with the subject that we talked about. But I don't know how it's connected. I mean, I guess that maybe they'd want to proliferate I think there's still a pretty significant minority. They have the Tokyo Manor, Central Park, and National Park. But, I don't know.